Yo Pods, check out Meet Mitch and Leewood for award-winning barbecue, outstanding atmosphere, and your destination to watch all your favorite March Madness action. Tailgating for opening day? Place your order online and pick up on way to the game. Meet Mitch Barbecue, East 95th and Mission in Ranch Martin or Shopping Center.
This is Almost Entirely Sports with Joshua Briscoe.
If you call the football the Duke, are you a D-bag?
On Sports Radio 810. WHB.
We simply could not let another day go by before we were going to talk again to our friend Ryan Tracy about everything the Chiefs did and didn't do in the 2022 NFL Draft. Of course, you can follow him on Twitter at Ryan Tracy NFL. You can hear him on Locked On Chiefs. You can check out RGR Football, RogueAPC.com, The Athletic Matrix, and I have open in a tab right now so we can cross-reference what Ryan will tell us about this draft class, all of that and so much more. Follow him on Twitter at Ryan Tracy NFL for everything there. But Ryan, first, foremost, maybe most importantly, does it make you a D-bag if you call the football the Duke?
I think you have to be affirmative about that. There's no way around that. It's an inanimate object. Don't call it John Wayne.
Give it a name. What is your favorite alternate way of calling a football a football? What are you? You a pigskin guy? Something else I'm not thinking of?
I just call it The Rock. It's just
The Rock. See, The Rock's a good one. I like The Rock as an actor.
So does Sean Connery. Oh, at least, you know, mostly.
Yeah. I feel good because I feel like if you said, you know what, I call it the Duke, I would think that maybe I was in the wrong, but I feel like now we've sorted all that out. Have you gotten any sleep in these last couple of weeks post-draft and maybe one just like 14-hour unconscious stretch?
Oh, yes. As soon as I got home from the draft, I spent a nice stretch in bed, probably 16 hours, and I've gotten myself up to my like 6-hour average since then.
That's good. Well, I'm glad. I have to imagine at that point it was like being in like some sort of like coma of just like, hey, nobody, don't try to get a hold of Ryan for the 16 hours. He's going to be completely unavailable, like in a hyperbaric chamber, like Walt Disney or something.
Yes, it was a steel lung that no one could mention the name Jermaine Johnson to me the whole time.
Yeah. Well, look, I was really going to start with something that I wanted to get something that you felt good about out of the Chiefs draft class, but you mentioned Jermaine Johnson first, and so I do have the notes that I took whenever we were talking pre-draft, and I have it next to a new fresh piece of paper, and one of the things I have here, again, as I noticed, I was going through my notes before the show today, I wrote down the phrase, should move up for Jermaine Johnson, and they moved up, and Jermaine Johnson was there. And I would love for you to put me in the room with you at that moment.
You know, I was live on television at the time. Mm-hmm. So my room was quite subdued, too, because it's all in my head. And I'm like, could they? Would they? They're on the clock now. It could be happening. And then I'm in the back of my head, I'm like, but I still have McDuffie higher on my board. Oh, they're going to go to the corner, and they're finally going to do what I've been asking for 3 years.
Yeah.
And they pulled it off. So I will not complain. I had McDuffie as a higher prospect. They got the better player, in my opinion, overall. So, hey, at least I was very happy to see that the Chiefs, what has again been their nature for the last 7 years, in that they saw an opportunity to go up and do something, and they did it in the first round, and they got themselves a top-tier player that should be on this roster for a very long time.
Well, so that is like a quintessential, they finally did it, but at what cost sort of moment of like, oh man, that, you know, you can't have it all, I guess. So let's start with McDuffie then, because you had him highly rated on your board, again, over Jermaine Johnson at that point. I was shocked whenever that announcement was made, or whenever I saw it on Twitter. I was in fact preparing for it to be Jermaine Johnson because I just thought that made a lot of sense. And you know, they got Karlaftis later. We'll talk about him momentarily. But what was it about McDuffie that had you so fully on board in the pre-draft process? And now that he fits into this defense, what do you see?
It's one word, and we hear it at every other position, but we don't always hear it at corner. It's versatility.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the thing that's made Legarius so profoundly unique in this defense is that you can move him around. Well, Trent's nearly as pliable He can play nickel corner. He can play outside corner. He's played some safety as well. Now you have two pieces that I think defenses are going to have to game plan away from, and you never know where they're going to line up. I think the two of them together gives you a 1-2 punch that you can really throw some coordinators for a loop as to what they're doing.
So, I mean, with Spags in particular, being able to do that with Snead and with even Rashad Fenton moved around some, they've obviously got 4,000 other defensive backs now. Where do you think McDuffie is at his best? Because you're right. As soon as you said we say this about other position groups, we don't often say it about the corners. I knew it was going to be versatility. But sometimes that also ends up being a synonym for, like, positionless. And I don't think that's what you're saying on McDuffie, certainly.
No. I think the big thing for me is you got to pick a poison and put him there, and then small variations, not this split game to game, where is he going to line up? I think it's more of a tactical thing than a scheme thing, so that it's much more rare from snap to snap, and I think that's the best way to use him. I would probably think the same as they thought at UW and keep him on the outside. Legarius come in on the inside on those downs, and I might even be tempted to have Legarius flip so that you're trying to play those guys close together, because that effectively gives you your two best cover corners on the same side of the ball that I think deters passing in that direction more effectively than keeping them separated.
I love that. I think that's super interesting. Is that something that you see very often? I've not really given that any thought. I think of almost all the time a team's number one corner is outside on one side and then outside on the other, and then, you know, all the time in sub packages, if either one of those guys kicked in, then you'd have the third guy on the opposite side. I don't think I've given a single moment of thought to the idea of trying to keep those guys on the same side of the field.
Yeah, it's not common, but when it works, it is significantly more difficult for an offense to pass the ball that direction. And then what you end up doing is you have to have somebody that you feel can hold their own on the other side with support. They don't have to be a shutdown corner. They have to be somebody that can win early in the routes, be physical, and contain routes so that you can have some safety help rolled over the top or there in specific route combinations to help them. And I think it's not a coincidence that they went out and got Lonnie Johnson as someone to supplement the physicality that you get with Fenton. And I think those two guys are going to be battling for the third spot.
Super interesting. Love that. On McDuffie, on the really, I think, the only, like, red flag or negative, or certainly the one that most people have spent some time talking about pre-draft and since then, is the size, and particularly the arm length. You've got a much better understanding of how much this stuff matters than most people, and certainly more than I do. So, like, how much pause did that give you for McDuffie? How much of a difference did that make between him and the corners that went before him? Are you expecting that to be a noteworthy concern at the NFL level?
It is definitely something that shows up, not only on film, but in production in the NFL. So you have to take note of it. If you just poo-poo it away, you're going to end up biting yourself. But I will say this, too. There's a reason he was corner three, and there was a pretty significant gap. I had him right where he was taken, at the very early 20s, whereas I had both Stingley and Gardner in the top 10, and that kind of illustrates the difference. It is a little bit more risk. But Trent in particular makes up for it by understanding the game at a higher level than most guys coming out. He played predominantly zone, 82%. So he's had an idea and an ability to watch the plays develop, the quarterback's progressions. He understands route concepts better than the average prospect coming out. That allowed him to be productive in deterring passes. It was like 44% with his completion percentage allowed as a senior. And he didn't take the ball away or get PBUs at an astronomical rate. He got a few, but he just was able to get to the point where the receiver wasn't able to concentrate or the ball was placed in a position because of his presence that it wasn't catchable. And those are the little things that make up for the arm length difference in the way that you align yourself and the way that you attack the ball once it's in the air. And quite frankly, a way that now, if you have them both on the same side, Legarius Snead and Trent McDuffie, it's very hard to see How can I squeeze a pass into a small window when I have those two guys over there? If they're separated, it drives all the passing into the middle of the field. So that is a concept that will help you as well, as long as you feel good about the nickel corner spot. And unfortunately, that's where you get in a little bit of trouble, because the nickel corner happens to be, in terms of rankings, the two best guys that are on the outside, too. Mm-hmm. It will be Sneed, and McDuffie is the best corner-capable guy. So it leaves a little bit there. That's why if you can get a strong corner that can play outside boundary, use the sideline to his advantage, and have help over the top, it lets you drive stuff to where you want the passing game to go. And that's an advantage that Steve hasn't had in quite a while.
Do you ever sit back and just try to come up with a reason behind how you know so many football things? Because every once in a while talking to you, I'll just ask a question, and I'm like, I'm not sure he's going to really have an answer for this. And then it's like you wrote a paper on it like a month ago. It's like, oh yeah, I just wrote a 7-page research paper on exactly how Trent McDuffie can overcome his arms being shorter than most.
You know, I watch a lot of ball, and I watch a lot of tape. And back when I was coaching, I went to a lot of clinics. I was not a position coach. I was a strength conditioning coach. I did a little work with linebackers when I was still in coaching. But I went to a lot of clinics, and I learned a lot of conceptual things that now I think are only emphasized more in the modern game that's so much more based on passing. It is so much the outliers. It's not the fundamentals of run blocking and everything that it used to take up so much clinic time. Now you see concepts that are then more adaptable when you see an athlete, at least when I see an athlete that has X, Y, or Z traits, I can extrapolate a little bit quicker. And I think that's something that the staff is working on as well, is being a little bit more adaptable when they are confronted with something that isn't working. So I like the changes they made on the staff. I think Daly at linebacker is going to be really interesting. I like Collins' fresh perspective on the front, and I'm hoping that that actually raises the floor of the performance of all the defensive linemen. And with today or yesterday's news, that's certainly something they're going to need.
You even had a great answer to that question and then segued into the one piece of recent news that I also wanted to ask you about. The only reason that I don't feel like you could just walk over here and take my job is that you don't live right here and you're too busy and wouldn't need it. Like that, I just... Like, why? Hey, everybody, well, just listen to, download the podcast and then just listen to these like 20 minutes whenever you get bored, and you'll just get smarter by osmosis.
Well, you're prettier than me, man, so it works.
Well, look, God had to give me one, right? I mean, I had to get something, you know, and maybe I can try to hold on to that for another year or so. But honestly, at the rate that you're at, I feel like next time I see you, it's just going to be like, hi, I'm Ryan Tracy Gosling. I've actually hyphenated my last name because now I also look like Ryan Gosling because I can't let anyone win anything. It's ridiculous.
Hey, you never know.
I'm afraid of what will happen with you having any breath of free time. So I'm going to just try to keep you busy so you don't get good at anything else.
That sounds good.
I will. I'll take your segue that you gave us for free on Melvin Ingram, because I wanted to spend a second on that, and then I will circle back to the draft class. But what did he do for this team last year? What are they losing without him? And then also, just not to get too deep into the weeds on George Karlaftis yet, because we're going to give him plenty of time in a second. But whenever you look at what this edge group looks like without Melvin Ingram on it, how does that make you feel?
It makes you a little bit concerned. Not just in general performance, but for the pressure that this puts on George. Mm-hmm. Being a young player at his draft age, being a young player in terms of experience overall in the game, this adds to it. Because this, having Melvin Ingram on the roster there for that 2 weeks where he was a ghost of a presence, it allowed you to envision a rep split that let George have some breathing room. And when you're a first-round pick, that's pretty rare. That's a nice thing to have. So I think this puts a little bit more pressure on him, but I will say this. The things that he is good at, he is very good at, and I think he'll be able to bring that to his game. His motor, his first step, and his hand fighting are going to let him transition better than a lot of guys that are probably going to have the more explosive plays, but won't be able to do it consistently. And now with the added rep load, I think he'll come along a little bit quicker than we all expected.
Well, that you, I was going to let you give some positives after I asked you about the alternative side here. So, but you snuck in some positives on Karloftis. Give me the haters handbook to George Karloftis. Why, whenever we talked before the draft, you said Spags is going to love him because of his power, but you were hoping the Chiefs would get a little more exotic in terms of experimenting a little bit more elsewhere. Or again, it was Jermaine Johnson. We even talked about Nick Bonito a little bit. What was it about Karloftis coming into the draft that had you and maybe still has you some amount of hesitant about him as a first round pick?
It's only the change of direction dynamic aspect of the game. Being able to bend is one thing, but sometimes even bend around the edge is overrated. It's about change of direction as well, because as a rookie, they're going to run at you. And you're going to be able to have to not only set the edge, you're going to have to be dynamic off of it in a lateral direction. He's very good at pass rushing forward. He can attack an outside shoulder. Once he gets there, he relies on power still. And so the coaching staff is going to have to try to get something dynamic out of him. It isn't going to be bend. I don't think he has that in his build and his anatomy. I don't see that changing. But I do think that they can train in to use his pad level more effectively. You see Von Miller use pad level. It's probably its extreme. Plus, he has the bend, so that makes him a two-edged force there. But getting a guy with as much power and as much quickness as Karloftis has off the go, and if he can change position vertically, that makes it troublesome for the tackles. And I think that will allow him to get into pads, develop a rip, and then he's into a body there where he can use his power and his lean to not bend around the edge, but crush the edge and flatten it through the tackle's body. And that's what he's going to have to get to. So initially, the movement skill is not what I wanted on film, because it's very much reminiscent of what we see in Spags' defensive ends. I want a little bit of something different. But that's not the way it worked out. So you take what he has well, you emphasize that, and then you try to find something that gives him a little bit of unpredictability, a little bit of back and forth, that he can keep tackles on their toes and affect hand placement and the punch of the tackles, try to get to a long arm that works. He's tried that before. It's been up and down. I think there are ways, technique-wise, that he can refine that and make that something useful.
I know that I'm really in dangerous territory of just complimenting you too much during this, but I love the idea of him needing to add unpredictability, because you're right. We talk about him not having much bend, and even the idea that that change of direction is more important than strictly being able to bend. But unpredictability is something you could add to a game in a number of ways, like what you just rattled through. That's an interesting way of framing that. But also, I feel like every time we talk about a rookie, it's either he's going to be a Hall of Famer or a bust. And I want to know what you think. Like, if you were really going to have to tie your reputation to this, I don't know how or why, but like, what is reasonable to expect of George Karloftis, both as a rookie and then in the larger, the career picture? What would you bet on his career looking like, more or less? And again, also this first season, especially with Ingram gone.
This first season, I think he's going to have some early success against less athletic tackles on probably lower level teams. And as you get into the playoff teams, and certainly the playoff run later in the year, it's going to be more challenging for him. So I see a race for him to, how can you change up and add something to your repertoire of pass rush attack? Mostly, I think, like the level of your pads and being able to be dynamic there, but also in your hand movement and what kind of counters you can come up with. And it's a race against them and the tackles to watch enough film on him to understand where he might go if he isn't able to add anything significant or be unpredictable enough to keep them on their toes. So it might be an up and down year first, this rookie season. Beyond that, I think he's got time, because he is such a young player and he is so light in the experience side. I think he's got the upside that more specific tutelage in that. I would not be surprised to see some kind of off-the-field martial arts training, hand-fighting training, like we saw Tamba, Master Kim years ago, that kind of thing. That probably can't happen until an off-season or two, but that, I think, will have an effect down the line. So I can't say that he's going to be Tamba Ali, but there are some similarities in game that has to still be progressed as a professional that he has the opportunity to do. So I do think that he can be more than he was in college, which quite frankly, was a powerhouse that demanded double teams and freed up other aspects of the defense. And if his presence clears up Chris Jones to be one-on-one, then this defense is winning this scenario.
With all of that being said about Karlaftis and McDuffie, if I don't know that this would have been the answer on either of those guys, but what was your favorite pick in the draft? You can take value into account if you want, player style, but the guy that got you the most fired up.
The guy that got me fired up is the guy that I think is going to be the difference maker that no one sees coming, and that's Brian Cook. Because you're losing Tyron, I think the threshold for expectation is really low for the replacement. But Cook does it all. He's got speed to turn with tight ends, some slot receivers. He hits like a ton of bricks. He's aware of the entire game. He understands route concepts. And it's all about being a sponge right now to pick up what Spags and Dave Merritt want him to do. And he even said that very thing in his first press conference, which tells me that they're hammering that into him already.
Mm-hmm.
I think coming from a program that got to the college football playoff is important because he's seen the ultimate level of competition in college, and that helps you make that adjustment. And his awareness on the field is something that I think really gives him an edge. It might take a little bit, especially in the dime packages that I do expect him to be rolled out in first, working with Juan Thornhill and Justin Reed. But I think in the end, he is the guy that has the best opportunity both in target capacity but in understanding of how offenses are going to try to attack them to be a guy that actually comes up and makes plays in game situations that turn games around. So I'm excited about Cook.
I was kind of hoping that would be your answer because he's one of these guys that I feel like, I don't know, maybe it's just this show, but like I feel like in the picks that have been around him and even some of the guys later on, I feel like Cook has almost sort of slipped through the cracks in the way that we're discussing them, in part because, again, like, you know, whenever you say, all right, he's your Dan Sorensen replacement, I think people's expectations immediately probably at this point in where Dan Sorensen has left us most recently, maybe those expectations are lowered by that comparison. But I also feel like you would say then again with the awareness in the field you mentioned in the draft guide that you know, great versus the run, but also that you like him best in short and intermediate routes. I feel like maybe we have oversimplified what he might bring in terms of being more of a well-rounded player than he's getting credit for. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's probably fair as well, because we also have to take into account how he was attacked in college. It wasn't from all angles. He was one of the better players on the field, so there was an aspect of them going away from Sauce and going away from him. So that plays a part as well, and I think the presence of Reed over the top will make that probably a less appetizing way to go, and it's going to bring them down to Cook and see what they can get on a rookie and see what they can make him do, see if they can fake him out with quarterback's eyes, with motion, with things that he's going to have to pay attention to at a much more fine level than he did in college. But I think it's going to be paying off in spades by midseason.
Another guy that, like, obviously this is going to be probably the, I don't know, the most nationally discussed pick for the Chiefs, because anytime Andy Reid adds a wide receiver, he gets his name showing up in fantasy football shows. But, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you might have been, I don't remember us talking about Sky Moore whenever we talked pre-draft. He's down the list a little bit in the guide. I think some of the stuff that you've mentioned about him has been very interesting to where he might now fit in this offense. But is it fair to say that you were not a, like, Sky Moore super fan coming into this draft, and then what do you think specifically also, because I know the game changes whenever it's a pick at 54, so the Sky Moore pick in general made you feel how?
It made me feel like they got really good value. I was not a huge Sky Moore fan. I didn't have him in the first round. I thought that was a little bit beyond ridiculous, pumping him up that far, but that's what happens in draft media. So I thought they got good value for where he is, and we have to remember, walking in, he's the fourth receiver on this roster.
Yeah.
He's not meant to be a starter. He doesn't have to perform like that. But he gives you a little bit of everything. And most importantly, he gives you the two things that I don't think are as easily replaceable in the loss of Tyreek Hill, in that his ability to run with the ball in his hands once he has possession and his ability to change direction. Those are two things that they haven't been able to replace any other way. No offense to Juju Smith-Schuster, but he doesn't move like that. You have the vertical aspect with McColl and obviously with MBS joining the roster, so you've taken away the deep threat part. But that just shiftiness underneath and his ability to create with the ball in his hand, you didn't have an answer to that until you got Sky Moore. And I think that allows you to hit him with short to intermediate passes and just let him do his thing. And I think it's going to pay off really well. It's just how quickly can he learn multiple roles in the offense so that he can get playing time. Eventually, I think a season from now, he will be the starting slot and he'll play predominantly there. But for now, it's about where can you get him reps in order for him to make an impact. I think that he will. I just don't know the degree yet until we see camp.
If we are having this conversation in 3 years and we go, oh, they Sky Moore after year three, he was still again, he was like receiver four for them, and going into year four, it's like, oh, this is probably nearing the end of the Sky Moore experiment. What would have gotten us to that point if we get to the end of his rookie contract and he hasn't particularly made an impact?
I don't think it will be physical unless he runs into some kind of problem with injuries. I think it will be a very similar story to what we talk about with Mecole Hardman, is recognizing reading defenses, being in the place that Patrick expects you to be, understanding how to adjust on the fly and what your expectations are. It's the mental part of the read offense that's the hardest, and I think that's the most difficult one to project. So if we're still having this conversation in 3 years, that's most likely the reason.
This is super granular, but is that exacerbated by him being coming out of Western Michigan, or is that just that would be true and that might be the answer for any of your top five or six receivers?
It could be true for anyone. And I don't know the Western Michigan offense well enough to say whether I think it translates or not. Mm-hmm. In the end, it's about the individual. It's about study habits. It's about aptitude to pick up angles, adjustments, the subtlety of what defensive backs are showing you, and being able to anticipate. It's about football knowledge and just being a football guy. From everything that I hear, he has that. So I'm feeling optimistic about it, but I won't say it has anything to do with his offense in college.
Then I feel like we can't let you go without getting you to talk about Leo Chanel at least a little bit. I think there are some interesting notes about incredible athleticism, not necessarily being incredible in coverage or change of direction or whatever, but also physically he's a menace, and I just would like to hear what you think about what Leo Chanel could be, because he just seems like a player that if you don't like while he's here, I'm going to really be heartbroken.
You have nothing to fear, because if it's up to me, they run a bare front and blitz him every single down, and I'm happy as a clam. Uh-huh. Because it's going to pay off more than it hurts you. But downhill, with his ability to trigger and just go attack the ball, his straight line athleticism is off the charts. He's one of the top 10 I've ever done in the Matrix, and that's 13 draft classes.
Crazy, so that tells you. Unbelievable.
In fact, the only two guys that are playing significant reps in the league today that actually tested out better than him as overall athletes are Isaiah Simmons and Willie Gay Jr. So that fit is incredible. And I think it's really intriguing because he said it when he first arrived in town, or maybe it was his post-draft interview, I can't remember, that all these things that you think I'm good at now, I wasn't very good at 3 years ago. Mm. So that tells you that he's still got a lot to learn and he's willing to do that. I like his ability to rush the passer as well. I don't think they can convert him to a true edge rusher, but as an overhang, some of the things we saw Reggie Ragland do, I think he's got way more aptitude for that than even Reggie did. And he can play off the ball and attack the run and attack the line of scrimmage in a way that makes guards pay attention, which, again, frees up the guys next to him, whether that's Frank Clark and Chris Jones or George Karlaftis, whoever it is. As a fifth rusher, he frees a lot of guys up to actually go make plays.
Well, so then I'll get you out of here on this then. If you look at that draft class as an entirety, and then also everything that you have been talking about now for years in terms of the athleticism that comes through, but also on the defensive side, although, you could also, I think, argue that Darian Kennard is a hitter, even though he's on the other side of the ball. Isaiah Pacheco and Sky Moore to some extent as well. But, like, whenever you look at what appears to be a concerted effort to get more athletic, more physical, more nasty, perhaps. I mean, what do you make of the draft class that we're looking at now, where that really does look like a common theme?
It does look like a common theme, and I think that tells you that just like everything else that this front office has attacked the last few years, that they identified an issue and they went to fix it. Mm. Does that mean that that's what we're going to see in subsequent classes for years and years and years? I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think they do like the uber athlete that may be more of a finesse player in general, especially on the offensive side.
Mm-hmm.
But they recognize that they have to have some guys that are enforcers, some guys that if fight breaks out in the field, you feel like you can win it. And I don't know if they felt like that the last few years.
Yeah.
So I like what they did, and I hope that they keep a thread of that running through the next few seasons. I mean, we're talking about 12 draft picks next year again.
Crazy.
So it certainly affords you the opportunity to keep that as part of your criteria. But I think it will be based on the class, really just taking the guy that fits what your current need is, whether it's toughness or nastiness or explosiveness or just football IQ to, you know, really change the game in a way that you feel you're lacking in. I do feel that this staff, as it evolves even, continues to stay focused on that, and you have to give credit to the top of it with Fred Beach in making sure that if you have an issue, you go fix it. You don't turn a blind eye. You don't hope that it turns around. You go make active efforts to fix your problems.
Ryan, I always appreciate you carving out some time for us tonight, especially when it lets us revisit everything here that we've learned through the draft class. I have another full legal pad sheet full of things I've written down now, which I guess since I brought back the pre-draft sheet today, I guess I'll bring this sheet out in 2 or 3 years and we can really figure out what exactly we got wrong.
Oh, yeah. Hold my feet to the fire.
Yeah, I will. I'll definitely not lose this tomorrow. There's no way I'll just lose this legal pad at some point. I'm not that person at all. I am that person. Thank you, Ryan. I really do appreciate it, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Good to talk to you.
It's Ryan Tracy. You follow him on Twitter at Ryan Tracy NFL, because if I was going to try to get every single thing he does into one breath here as we send him out and go to the next break, I would run out of time. So follow him on Twitter at Ryan Tracy NFL. Locked On Chiefs, Rogue Analytics, RGR Football. He just, again, like if you follow him on Twitter, you'll see also as he does more stuff. He was live during the entire draft. It's just, the draft guide still has pinned tweet if you want to learn more about the athletes that the Chiefs have added. It's an incredible resource. I literally had it up while we were talking to him just now. And also, he just knows more about football than I do, or than you do, or than your next favorite Chiefs commentator knows. I think in that particular cage match, I would take Ryan Tracy against just about anybody. I also think I would take him in a literal cage match against just about anybody. Regardless of the format, if it's in a cage, I'll take Ryan Tracy.
This is Almost Entirely Sports with Joshua Briscoe.
But that's not where this show makes its money. You guys know that. We make our money talking about the Chiefs. And dunking on people on Twitter.
On Sports Radio 810 WHB.
Hey, programming note. This is the only AES of the week, by the way. I'll be on air plenty, but tomorrow night we've got the Sporting Kansas City show and then the NBA Eastern Conference Finals, Game 1, Miami versus Boston. I really do think that series is going to be a lot of fun. I am looking forward to that. Not so much Wednesday night's post-soccer programming, because
why do you hate Chad and Dave Borscht doing the final whistle, Josh?
No. I mean post final whistle.
I like you, Chad Reynolds.
I like all those. I really do. I personally like all of the final whistle crew, and I also like Sporting. Not that they've done anything to earn that relatively recently,
but that's not
what I mean. No. I'm gonna give you the full nighttime schedule these 2 days, because now I've really lost the plot. I really got lost by accidentally shading the final whistle, which was absolutely not my intention. They do a fabulous job, and they're currently doing a better job at their job than Sporting is at their job. You know, so hey, I'm very supportive of both of the entire operation around Sporting. But so tomorrow night we got the Sporting KC show and the NBA Eastern Conference Finals. Then Wednesday we got the PGA Championship Advent Health Championship preview at 6:30. That'll take you up to kickoff of Sporting KC versus Colorado at 7:30. Then the exceptional Final Whistle postgame show, maybe my favorite programming in the history of radio, and certainly some of my favorite people to do it. But then after that, we'll bring you the remainder of the Western Conference Finals Game 1 of Golden State versus Dallas. And the thing that hurts me is not just
that. Do you have a preference in that game?
Yes.
I mean, yes. Golden State feels better, right?
Yes.
Okay.
100%. First of all, let me say this, is that one thing is like, hey, you know, I obviously love doing this show, but like last year I got to watch every finals game because we didn't, I mean, I might have had some shows right before finals games. I think we carried all six. And it's like being able to watch the Suns play meaningful late playoff basketball has been a blast.
It's fun.
But now I'm going to be home and I'm going to flip on the TV.
Yeah.
And I'm going to watch Golden State versus Dallas, which.
Let's go Miami.
Oh, man. And then Thursday, Eastern Conference Finals on Thursday and Western Conference Finals again on Friday. But Thursday, Friday, and Monday, I'll be filling in for Corey Anderson on The Zone across from Jason Anderson. No relation. But I'll be in on The Zone Thursday, Friday, Monday. So no AES the rest of the week. Plenty of playoff basketball, and you can hear me from 10 to 2 for those 3 days. So I'll be around, but this is the only true AES of the week. And then, to answer your question, Rudy, I was bargaining. I was in the bargaining stage last night. And yeah, it stinks because a part of me really did love Luka, like particularly, you know, the pre-draft process.
Yeah.
And then much of it since
because
then.
He was, the Suns were obviously going to draft him. Number one overall pick.
Yeah.
Suns had the number one overall pick.
I would have.
Hired his head coach, funny enough.
Yeah. Shout out to Igor one more time. So for what it is now at this point.
He had a goat allergy, unfortunately.
That's a pretty good reference. So for me, the issue is that as much as I, like at one point, did want Luka to succeed, now that he vanquished the Suns, it becomes kind of personal.
Yep.
And if the Warriors just win another final or get to another one, win the whole thing,
and it's
just another finals for the Warriors.
But it's also
kind of
a cool story because it's
yeah,
the,
old guys
it's
running back one more time.
Right? Like they were the dominant team. And then, just Klay Thompson just gets hurt for almost 3 years, right? Like Kevin Durant gets hurt in a finals that cost them a finals. And now they have a chance to get back, right? So, like, it is kind of a cool, like, it's almost like a retro team, even though the team won a title, like, 3 or 4 years ago.
If the Warriors get back.
It kind of feels like a retro team.
No, it does. If the Warriors get back and win another finals, it's the Expendables.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's the one where it's all the old people coming back for more action movie, right? Like, it's that. Which, again,
like, six more action movies, because I think we're on Expendables, like, six.
That seems right.
But I get your point.
One more action franchise.
Yeah.
Where, you know, again, especially Klay, but Steph to some extent, Draymond to some extent. But then you also have the new young guys that come in and keep everybody young. Maybe
bleep Jordan Poole.
I know, no kidding.
That man was not anything all year, and then he decides to drop like 30 a game on Denver. Like, okay.
Andrew Wiggins is fixed, I guess.
Wiggins had no interest in playing defense, and now he is like Golden State. But obviously, Draymond is their number one defender.
Sure.
But like after that, it's Wiggins. When Wiggins is the guy that they frequently will put on the other team's best guard. And he's good at it.
It's ridiculous. But so maybe
it's almost like being on a team that's functional, like organizationally, can be beneficial.
I wouldn't know.
Same.
So maybe with the Warriors, maybe it's a late phase two Avengers movie.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Where you know you've got some of the. Tony Stark is not at his peak of the peak of his powers.
Ooh.
Captain America is thinking about hanging him up. Maybe I don't know if that's late phase three at that point. Maybe I think we're in phase four now.
At that point, it's more phase three.
But all of a sudden, Tom Holland shows. Jordan Poole shows up. Like, hi guys, I just got bit by a spider. What can I do?
Steph Curry is definitely Iron Man. And he's
definitely.
Just like every now and then, he's just like, you dumb kid. He's got to fix his problem.
Yes.
But also, like, you know, Jordan Poole's got some stuff used to have. He doesn't really have yet. And when Steph does hang it up, you know who he's living those pairs of glasses to? That have the killing droids or drones? Jordan Poole.
I guess Jordan Poole gets the glasses. I don't know.
He gets the glasses.
But I do think that regardless, I'm just going to root for the East. I
can't root for the Celtics, but I'm a Heat guy. I like Spoelstra. I think he's a really good coach, and I think it would be cool for him to get a title without, the big three, right?
I agree.
For him. And also, you know who's on that team? I got two Wildcats.
You
got
Tyler
Bam,
Hero.
And I got Tyler Hero.
Wow, God, I forgot Bam.
Bam
How long was Bam there?
At Kentucky?
Yeah.
Well, both of them were just there for a year.
Okay.
Both were one and done.
I just don't remember Bam at Kentucky at all.
He was only there for a year, and he was not, he was good at Kentucky, but he was not like earth-shattering at Kentucky. Now, it was definitely one of those situations where, like, as the year went on,
it was like, hey, draft him. He's going to figure it out.
He got better. But he did not, like, take Kentucky by storm the way, you know, just the way some other, like, he wasn't Carl Anthony Towns, he wasn't Anthony Davis. Honestly, he was a bit more like Devin Booker, Kentucky, where it was, like, it was a good year, but it was a little bit more under the radar, right? Like, other guys overshadowed him. But, like, he clearly had the skill set, you know? You're just like, yeah, this guy's going to be good. Or should be good.
So yeah, you get two Kentucky guys, and yeah, I was leaning that direction. Here's the thing: is
and Jimmy Butler, like, being able to be like to Philadelphia, who even said like, yeah, I should probably be a 76er right now. And Joel Embiid's like, yeah, I mean, I don't know why y'all are expecting James Harden to be good at basketball. So it's just not who he is anymore.
So I know that was incredible. Yeah, I guess I would go that way. Here's the thing: is part of me, you know, I think, and maybe this is just, you know, having my heart broken so many times.
Yeah,
I would not be angry if the Spirit of Beards was allowed to see his team win a championship.
I wouldn't be angry. I'd just be disappointed.
But the offsetting of the rest of Boston is something that Beards himself just cannot overhaul for me.
Boston's won too much.
And there's just a good chunk of people who I don't necessarily want to see be happy about basketball. Like, and I'm not even being vague on purpose. Like, just, it's basically Barstool and Bill Simmons. You know what? Simmons is happy, I'm pissed.
I mean, if he's happy anywhere but Phoenix.
The number of times that Scott and I have texted about the Suns acquiring Ben Simmons.
Scott tweets about the Suns acquiring Ben Simmons.
Somewhere in the second half of that game, I tweeted out the trade simulator for Chris Paul for Ben Simmons straight up, and it did work financially. I'm sure KD would rather play with Chris Paul.
Did you see Scott's tweet of just four random trades that just all involved DeAndre Ayton?
Yes, I did.
Lillard one, man, that would be...
We've talked about Lillard a lot also.
Did you see Dame's tweet, that how it started versus how it's going?
No.
So it's a graphic of him, right, of how it started. It's just him, and it's like rookie of the years, like one, MVP zero, final zeros, beard not grown, and then how it's going. Rookie of the years one, MVP zero, final zeros, beard grown. It's just the beard is just grown.
Brutal, man.
Dame did it. Brutal. He put it out there.
Oh, he tweeted it?
Yeah, that was his tweet. Just like how it started versus how it's going. Just like nothing changed except I grew a beard.
Man.
He's so good.
Do you think he regrets anything? Because, man, he could have been... If he's your second best player almost anywhere, that team is a legit contender. And I can't tell you how far the farthest the Blazers made it.
Yeah, you know...
And this year they were irrelevant. I don't know if he was even healthy.
It's hard to be... Like, I guess if you're Dame, you came from such a small school, like... I mean, he's competitive. He obviously wants to win.
Portland seems chill.
It seems like a cool place to be, you know, young and rich in. But also, like, yeah, I think Dame is getting close to the, if he hasn't gotten there already, especially with them trading CJ McCollum, I think he's getting close to the ring chasing portion of his face, where it's like, hey, I made my money. I have established who I am in this city. This is probably where I'll move back to when I'm done, right? Like, I am a legend in this city. I'm one of the all-time greats.
But it's not happening in Portland.
It's time for me to go get my ring.
Yeah. Yeah, he was...
He just wants to come down to Denver. I know he's a huge Jokic fan. Just, you know, Dame, Jamal, Jokic. I'm just saying.
He did only play 29 games this year and was ruled out for the year in March. So
yeah, that's what I'm saying, though. This is my point. Like,
I'm just 31.
Yeah, he is getting, which is just crazy to be like, yeah, 31. He's ancient. He's my age.
He'll be 32 in a couple of months, but he's 31 right now.
But like, he is definitely, I think, getting to that point of his career where it's time. Here's the thing: if he decides like, hey, I just want to be in Portland the rest of my life, there's nothing wrong with that. Portland. Being rich in Portland seems awesome. And being, like, the guy of a franchise seems cool. But also, like, if you want to get just a ring, it's time to start ring chasing. Denver's just basically Denver's just the mountain in Portland.
Well, that hold on.
Denver's just mountain Portland.
I think Phoenix has more mountains than Denver.
It's the Rocky Mountains.
Phoenix has
a mountain. Phoenix
itself, I guess, fair enough.
Mountain.
Arizona has the Grand Canyon, you know? I mean, I don't know what else.
It's not really a mountain. It's
sort of like an inverse mountain. Anyway, maybe Damian Lillard is just a starter for the Denix Snuggets or whatever we came up with in the first hour. It's been a while. It's been a whole show. I can't even remember our own previous jokes, but Damian Lillard will be right there. Probably not winning playoff games with our Snenver Duggets or whatever. I'm honestly afraid that I'm going to accidentally curse if I keep making that portmanteau of a name. I don't even know what word it would be, but I just feel like somewhere around snug and the PH sound of Phoenix, really, I'm going just Denver only, because if I start talking about the the first half of Phoenix and the last half of Nuggets, that right there, that's it. I found, that is the landmine. So I just can't just go, I guess, Nuggets, but then the N wouldn't be there. It sounds like I'm saying
You're listening to Almost Entirely Sports with Joshua Briscoe.
You have 24 seconds to preview the NBA season.
Oh, gosh. Really. We're doing this again?
But very concisely. Please be better than last time.
Oh,
you, you do it in 24 seconds and not 15 minutes. Go.
Cool. This is very short-sighted. NBA starts tomorrow. Cleveland-Boston. I don't know if LeBron's playing, which... that could be bad. Oh, Josh wants his mic on now. Cool.
What games are you looking forward to the most? Turn the mic off again.
That one. Oklahoma, Golden State. Or not Golden State. Oklahoma, New... no.
Truly horrendous.
On Sports Radio 810 WHB.
I just love that we had our basketball expert there. It was Beards McFly, basketball enthusiast, to preview an upcoming NBA season. And it's the worst 24 seconds of radio I've ever heard anyone do, except for in the context of Almost Entirely Sports. It's beautiful.
It's so perfect.
You know that Kicks Under Cost account?
That game.
They have this there's a Gucci hoodie that they said was on sale for 35% off. It's black hoodie with like this sort of rainbow like starburst sort of thing across the big G logo in the middle.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh man, that looks like something I would wear all the time. I expect it was going to be expensive, but I saw it was 35% off. So I was like, you know what? I'm not, you know, let me click it. Let me look.
I got radio money. I can check this out.
On sale. It is $625.
Bargain.
Retailed for $1,959. Oh, sorry. An extra 15% off applied at checkout.
Heck of a sale, Josh. Can't pass it up.
I don't even know why I clicked it, honestly. I don't know what the number would have had to have been. I wouldn't spend $100 on a great hoodie, I don't think.
$420. $69.
I guess I would have paid slightly less than $70, but yeah, I'm not going to be buying this one. Talk to you next week. Bye, Mom.